example, and they struggle with implementation. In the mode of impulse, they love to debate and destroy others' arguments. They use knowledge for strength and power and are intellectually curious. And in the mode of goodness, they use knowledge to help people find their purpose, aspire to better themselves in order to give more, and realize knowledge is not theirs to use alone, but that they are here to serve. And finally, let's take a look at leaders. Originally, kings, warriors. Today, military, justice, law enforcement, politics. Their skills include governing, inspiring, engaging others. Natural leaders of people, movements, groups, and families. They're directed by courage, strength, and determination. They seek to protect those who are less privileged. They're led by higher morals and values and seek to enforce them across the world. They provide structures and frameworks for the growth of people. They like to work in teams, and they're great at organization, focus, and dedication to a mission. In the mode of ignorance, they give up on change due to corruption and hypocrisy. They develop a negative, pessimistic viewpoint, and they lose their moral compass in drive for power. In the mode of impulse, they build structures and frameworks for fame and money, not meaning. They use their talents to serve themselves, not humanity. They focus on short-term goals for themselves. And in the mode of goodness, they fight for higher morals, ethics, and values. They inspire people to work together. They build long-term goals to support society. And let's look at the connections between guides and leaders. Guides and leaders complement each other. Guides give wisdom to leaders. Leaders give structure to guides. The point of the Varanas is to help you understand yourself so you can focus on your strongest skills and inclinations. Self-awareness gives you more focus. When I look at my guide tendencies, it makes sense to me that I succeed when I focus on strategy. Creators and makers are better at implementation, so I've surrounded myself with people who can help me with that. A musician might be a maker, driven by security. In order to succeed, they might need to be surrounded by strategists. Invest in your strengths and surround yourself with people who can fill in the gaps. When you know your Varna, your passion and skills, and you serve with that, it becomes your Dharma. Try this. Reflected best self exercise. Choose a group of people who know you well. A diverse mix of people you've worked with, family, and friends. As few as 3 will work, but 10 to 20 is even better. Ask them to write down a moment when you were at your best. Ask them to be specific. Look for patterns and common themes. Write out a profile of yourself, aggregating the feedback as if it weren't about you. Think about how you can turn your best skills into action. How can you use those skills this weekend? In different circumstances or with different people? Test drive your Dharma. The Vedic personality test helps you begin to see your Varna, but just like a horoscope, it can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. It's up to you to test these Varnas in the real world through exploration and experimentation. If your Varna is leader, try to take on that role at work or by organizing your kid's birthday party. Do you genuinely take joy in the process? Think about the level of awareness we have when we eat something. We immediately do a sense check and decide if we like it, and we wouldn't have trouble rating it on a scale of 1 to 10 if asked to do so. Furthermore, we might have different feelings about it the next day. When I have my favorite chocolate brownie sundae on a Sunday night, I feel pretty happy about it. But by Monday morning, I no longer think it was the best thing in the world to put in my body. With both immediate and long-term reflection, we form nuanced opinions about whether we want to make that food part of our regular diet. All of us do this with food. We do it when we leave a movie theater. Did you like it? And some of us do it on Yelp. But we don't think to measure our compatibility with and taste for how we spend our time. When we get in the habit of identifying what empowers us, we have a better understanding of ourselves and what we want in life. This is exactly what we're going to do to refine our understanding of our Varna. The first and most critical question to ask when you're exploring your varna is, did I enjoy the process? Test the description of your varna against your experience to pinpoint what you enjoyed about it. Instead of saying, I love taking pictures, find the root of it. Do you like helping families put together a Christmas card that makes them proud? Guide. Do you like to document human struggles or other meaningful situations in order to promote change? Leader. Or do you like the technical aspects of lighting, focus, and developing film? Maker. As monks, every time we completed an activity or thought exercise like the ones in this audiobook, we asked ourselves questions. What did I like about that? Am I good at it? Do I want to read about it, learn about it, and spend a lot of my time doing it? Am I driven to improve? What made me feel comfortable or uncomfortable? If I was uncomfortable, was it in a positive way, a challenge that made me grow, or a negative way? This awareness gives us a much more nuanced view of where we thrive. Instead of sending us on one and only one path, that awareness opens us to new ways we can put our passions to use. Try this. Keep an activity journal. Take note of every activity you take part in through the course of a few days. Meetings, walking the dog, lunch with a friend, writing emails, preparing food, exercising, spending time on social media. For every activity, answer the two questions fundamental to Dharma. Did I enjoy the process? Did other people enjoy the result? There are no right or wrong answers. This is an observation exercise to amplify your awareness. Embrace your Dharma. Our heads might try to convince us that we've only ever made the best choices, but our true nature, our passion and purpose, isn't in our heads, it's in our hearts. In fact, our heads often get in the way of our passions. Here are some of the excuses that we use to close our minds. I'm too old to start my own business. It would be irresponsible of me to make this change. I can't afford to do this. I already know that. I've always done it this way. That way won't work for me. I don't have time. Past beliefs, false or self-deceiving, sneak in to block our progress. Fears prevent us from trying new things. Our egos get in the way of learning new information and opening up ourselves to growth. More on this in Chapter 8. And nobody ever has time for change, but miracles happen when you embrace your Dharma. Growing up, Joseph Campbell had no model of a career that fit his diverse interests. As a child in the early 1900s, he became fascinated by Native American culture and studied everything he could about it. During college, he became entranced with the rituals and symbols of Catholicism. While studying abroad, his interests expanded to include the theories of Jung and Freud, and he developed an interest in modern art. Back at Columbia, Campbell told his dissertation advisors that he wanted to blend ancient stories about the Holy Grail with ideas in art and psychology. They rejected that idea. He abandoned work on his thesis and in 1949 found a job teaching literature at Sarah Lawrence College, which he held for 38 years. Meanwhile, he published hundreds of books and articles and did a deep dive into ancient Indian mythology and philosophy. But it was in The Hero with a Thousand Faces that he first discussed his groundbreaking ideas about what he called the hero's journey, a concept that established Campbell as one of the foremost authorities on mythology and the human psyche. As someone who followed his Dharma, it's no surprise that Joseph Campbell is the original source of the advice, follow your bliss. He wrote, "Now I came to this idea of bliss because in Sanskrit, which is the great spiritual language of the world, there are three terms that represent the brink, the jumping off place to the ocean of transcendence. Sat, Chit, Ananda. The word Sat means being. Chit means consciousness. Ananda means bliss or rapture. I thought, I don't know whether my consciousness is proper consciousness or not. I don't know whether what I know of my being is proper being or not. But I do know where my rapture is. So let me hang on to rapture, and that will bring me both my consciousness and my being. I think it worked. If you follow your bliss, he said, doors will open for you that wouldn't have opened for anyone else. Protective instincts hold us back or steer us toward practical decisions. Campbell did teach literature for 38 years, but we can see past them and follow our dharma if we know what to look for. Dharma is of the body. Instead of listening to our minds, we must pay attention to how an idea or activity feels in our bodies. First, when you visualize yourself in a process, do you feel joy? Does the idea of it appeal to you? Then when you actually do the activity, how does your body respond? When you're in your element, you can feel it. Number one, alive. For some people, being in their dharma means they feel a calm, confident satisfaction. For others, there is a thrill of joy and excitement. In either case, you feel alive, connected, with a smile on your face, a light comes on. Number two, flow. In dharma, there is a natural momentum. You feel like you're in your lane, swimming with the current, instead of struggling through a resistant surf. When you are truly aligned, there is a sense of flow. You come out of your own head and lose track of time. Number three, comfort. In your dharma, you don't feel alone or out of place, no matter who comes or goes or where you are physically. Where you are feels right, even if the place where you feel right is traveling the world. I don't like the feeling of danger, but I have a friend who loves fast cars and jet skis. The danger, the worst case scenario, is the same for both of us, but for him, it is worth it. Or the danger itself is a joy. On stage, I'm in my element, but someone else would shut down. Number four, consistency. If you have a great time snorkeling on vacation, that doesn't mean snorkeling, or being on vacation for that matter, is your dharma. Being in your dharma bears repeating. In fact, it gets better the more you do it. But a single event is a clue to what energy you like, when and how you feel alive. Number five, positivity and growth. When we're aware of our own strengths, we're more confident. We value others' abilities more, and we feel less competitive. The inclination to compare yourself to others may not go away completely, but it shrinks because you only compare yourself to people within your area of expertise. Rejection and criticism don't feel like assaults. They feel like information that we can accept or reject, depending on whether they help us move forward. Dharma is your responsibility. Once you have a sense of your dharma, it's up to you to set up your life so that you can live it. We're not always going to be in a place or situation where others recognize our dharma and bend over backward to help us fulfill it. As we all have experienced at one time or another, bosses don't always tap into their employees' potential. If you're listening to this chapter, thinking, "My manager needs to understand dharma, then she'll give me the promotion," you've missed the point. We will never live in an idyllic world where everyone constantly lives their dharma, with occasional pauses for their bosses to call and ask if they're truly fulfilled. It is our responsibility to demonstrate and defend our dharma. The Manusmriti says that dharma protects those who protect it. Dharma brings you stability and peace. When we have the confidence to know where we thrive, we find opportunities to demonstrate that. This creates a feedback loop. When you safeguard your dharma, you constantly strive to be in a place where you thrive. When you thrive, people notice and you reap rewards that help you stay in your dharma. Your dharma protects your joy and your sense of purpose and helps you grow. Stretch your dharma. A person who isn't living their dharma is like a fish out of water. You can give the fish all the riches in the world, but it will die unless it's returned to the water. Once you discover your dharma, strive to play that role in every aspect of your life. Follow your passion in the workplace, take up community issues using the same skill set, be in your dharma with your family, in sports, in relationships, during days out with friends. If my dharma is to be a leader, I'm probably the one who should be planning the family holidays. I will feel meaning in that role. But if I'm a leader and I'm not playing that role, I'll feel insignificant and frustrated. Perhaps you're thinking, Jay, it makes no sense to stick with your dharma. Everyone knows that you should push yourself, try new things, venture out of your comfort zone. Though your dharma is your natural state, its range is further than your comfort zone. For instance, if your dharma is to be a speaker, you can go from an audience of 10 to an audience of 100, scaling the size of your impact. If you speak to students, you can start speaking to CEOs. It's also important to stretch your dharma. I'm not the most outgoing person in the world, but I go to events and meetings because I know connecting with people serves my purpose. Going against your dharma is a bit like roller skating. You feel off balance, slightly out of control, and exhausted afterward. But the more you understand yourself, the more solid your footing, you can consciously skate off in a new direction for a higher purpose. Understanding your dharma is key to knowing when and how to leave it behind. Our dharmas evolve with us. A British expat, Emma Slade, lived in Hong Kong, where she worked as an investor for a global bank managing accounts worth more than $1 billion. "I loved it," says Slade. "It was fast, it was exciting. I ate balance sheets for breakfast." Then in September 1997, Slade was on a business trip in Jakarta, Indonesia, when an armed man pushed a gun into her chest, robbed her, and held her hostage in her hotel room. She says that as she lay cowering on the floor, she learned the value of human life. Fortunately, police arrived before Slade was physically harmed. Later, when police officers showed her a photograph of the man slumped against the hotel wall surrounded by spatters of blood, Slade was shocked to feel sadness and compassion for him. That feeling stuck with her and led her to pursue the question of her real purpose. Slade quit her job and began exploring yoga and the nature of mind. In 2011, she traveled to Bhutan, where she met a monk who left an indelible impression on her. Been there. In 2012, she became a Buddhist nun, and Slade, now also known as Pema Dakhi, felt she'd finally found peace. Yet that feeling of compassion she'd felt for the man who attacked her returned. And Slade realized she needed to do something to put her compassion into action. So in 2015, she founded a UK-based charity called Opening Your Heart to Bhutan, which seeks to meet the basic needs of people in the rural areas of East Bhutan. Though she found fulfillment in becoming a nun, it was never her dharma to sit in a cave and meditate for the rest of her life. She now deploys her financial acumen in a way that serves herself and others more richly. Slade says, "The skills of old have been very useful in bringing me now a very meaningful and happy life." Slade compares her experience to the lotus flower, which begins in the mud, then grows upward through the water as it seeks light. In Buddhism, the lotus represents the idea that the mud and muck of life's challenges can provide fertile ground for our development. As the lotus grows, it rises through the water to eventually blossom. The Buddha says, just like a red, blue, or white lotus, born in the water, grown in the water, rising up above the water, stands unsmeared by the water. In the same way, I, born in the world, grown in the world, having overcome the world, live unsmeared by the world. Jakarta was my mud, Slade says in her TEDx talk, but it was also the seed of my future development. Remember the whole equation of dharma. Dharma isn't just passion and skills. Dharma is passion in the service of others. Your passion is for you, your purpose is for others. Your passion becomes a purpose when you use it to serve others. Your dharma has to fill a need in the world. As I've said, monks believe that you should be willing to do whatever is needed when there's a higher purpose, and monks live this fully. But if you're not a monk, the way to see it is that the pleasure you feel in doing your passion should equal how much others appreciate it. If others don't think you're effective, then your passion is a hobby, which can add richness to your life. This doesn't mean every activity outside your dharma is a waste of time. For all of us, there are activities in life that are competence building and activities that are character building. When I was first asked to give talks, I built competence in my dharma. But when I was asked to take out the trash, it built my character. To build your competence without regard for character is narcissistic, and to build character without working on skills is devoid of impact. We need to work on both in order to serve our souls and a higher purpose. Knowing your purpose and fulfilling it is easier and more fruitful when you use your time and energy wisely every day. In the next chapter, we will talk about how to get the best start to your day and how to follow through from there. Six, routine. Location has energy, time has memory. Every day, think as you wake up, today I'm fortunate to be alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it. The Dalai Lama. There are 12 of us, maybe more, sleeping on the floor, each on a thin yoga-type pad, covered by a simple sheet. The walls of the room are made of packed cow dung that feels like rough plaster and gives the place a not unpleasant earthy smell. The unfinished stone floors are worn smooth, but a far cry from memory foam. There are no finished windows in this building. We're in an interior room that keeps us dry in the rainy season and has plenty of doors for ventilation. Although I sleep here every night, there is no particular space that I consider mine. We steer clear of ownership here. No possessions, no material attachments. Right now, the room is dark as a cave. But from the tenor of the birds outside, our bodies know that it's 4 a.m. Time to wake up. We're due at collective prayers in half an hour. Without speaking a word, we move to the locker room. Some of us showering, some of us pulling on our robes. We wait in line to brush our teeth at one of the four communal sinks. No one from the outside world is a witness to our activity, but if they were, they would see a group of seemingly well-rested men, all of whom appear perfectly content to be getting up at this early hour. It wasn't always that easy. Every morning, my brain, desperate to remain shut down just a little bit longer, thought of a different excuse for why I should sleep in. But I pushed myself to adopt this new routine because I was committed to the process. The fact that it was hard was an important part of the journey. Eventually, I learned the one infallible trick to successfully getting up earlier. I had to go to sleep earlier. That was it. I'd spent my entire life pushing the limits of each day, sacrificing tomorrow because I didn't want to miss out on today. But once I finally let that go and started going to sleep earlier, waking up at 4 became easier and easier. And as it became easier, I found that I could do it without the help of anyone or anything besides my own body and the natural world around it. This was a revelatory experience for me. I realized I'd never in my life begun my day without being startled in one way or another. When I was a teenager, my morning summons came in the form of my mother screaming, "Jay, wake up!" from downstairs. In later years, an alarm clock performed the same thankless task. Every day of my life had begun with a sudden, jarring intrusion. Now, however, I was waking up to the sounds of birds, trees rustling in the wind, a stream of water. I woke to the sounds of nature. At last, I came to understand the value in it. The point of waking up early wasn't to torture us. It was to start the day off with peace and tranquility. Birds, a gong, the sound of flowing water, and our morning routine never varied. The simplicity and structure of ashram mornings spared us from the stressful complexity of decisions and variation. Starting our day so simply was like a mental shower. It cleansed us of the challenges of the previous day, giving us the space and energy to transform greed into generosity, anger into compassion, loss into love. Finally, it gave us resolve, a sense of purpose to carry out into the day. In the ashram, every detail of our life was designed to facilitate the habit or ritual we were trying to practice. For example, our robes. When we rose, we never had to think about what to wear. Like Steve Jobs, Barack Obama, and Arianna Huffington, all of whom have been known to have their own basic uniforms, monks simplified their clothing so as not to waste energy and time on dressing for the day. We each had two sets of robes, one to wear and one to wash. In similar fashion, the early morning wake-up was designed to launch the day in the right spirit. It was an ungodly hour, yet it was spiritually enlightening. I would never wake up that early, you may be thinking. I can't think of a worse way to start the day. I understand that perspective since I used to feel the same way. But let's take a look at how most people currently start their day. Sleep researchers say 85% of us need an alarm clock to wake up for work. When we wake up before our bodies are ready, the hormone melatonin, which helps to regulate sleep, is usually still at work, which is one of the reasons we grope for the snooze button. Unfortunately, our productivity-driven society encourages us to live like this. Maria Popova, a writer who's best known as the curator of brain pickings, writes, "We tend to wear our ability to get by on little sleep as some sort of badge of honor that validates our work ethic. But what it is a profound failure of self-respect and of priorities." Then, once we've woken up after too little sleep, nearly a quarter of us do something else that starts us out on the second wrong foot of the day. We reach for our cell phones within 1 minute of waking up. Over half of us are checking messages within 10 minutes. A majority of people go from out cold to processing mountains of information within minutes every morning. There are only 6 cars that can go from 0 to 60 miles per hour in under 2 seconds. Like most cars, humans are not built for that kind of sudden transition, mentally or physically. And the last thing you need to do when you've just woken up is to stumble straight into tragedy and pain, courtesy of news headlines or friends venting about gridlock on their commute. Looking at your phone first thing in the morning is like inviting 100 chatty strangers into your bedroom before you've showered, brushed your teeth, fixed your hair. Between the alarm clock and the world inside your phone, you're immediately overwhelmed with stress, pressure, anxiety. Do you really expect yourself to emerge from that state and have a pleasant, productive day? In the ashram, we started each morning in the spirit of the day we planned to have, and we trained ourselves to sustain that deliberateness and focus all day long. Sure, that's all fine and good if your daily schedule involves prayer, meditation, study, service, and chores, but the outside world is more complex. Early to rise. Here is my first recommendation. Wake up 1 hour earlier than you do now. No way, you say. Why would I want to wake up any earlier than I do right now? I don't get enough sleep as it is. Besides, yuck. But hear me out. None of us wants to go to work tired and then get to the end of the day feeling like we could have done more. The energy and mood of the morning carries through the day, so making life more meaningful begins there. We're used to waking up just before we have to get to work, or to a class, or to a workout, or to shuttle children off to school. We leave ourselves just enough time to shower, eat breakfast, pack up, etc. But having just enough time means not having enough time. You run late, you skip breakfast, you leave the bed unmade, you can't take the time to enjoy your shower, brush your teeth properly, finish your breakfast, or put everything away so you'll return to a tidy home. You can't do things with purpose and care if you have to speed through them. When you start the morning with high pressure and high stress, you're programming your body to operate in that mode for the rest of the day through conversations, meetings, appointments. Waking up early leads to a more productive day. Successful business people are already onto this. Apple CEO Tim Cook starts his day at 3:45 a.m. Richard Branson is up at 5:45. Michelle Obama rises at 4:30. But it's important to note that while lots of high-impact people rise early, there's also a movement among top executives to reclaim sleep. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos makes it a priority to get 8 hours of sleep every night, saying that less sleep might give you more time to produce, but the quality will suffer. So if you're going to rise early, you need to turn in at an hour that allows you to get a full night's rest. Life gets more complicated if you have kids or a night job. So if these or other circumstances make the idea of waking up an hour earlier unfathomable, don't despair. Start with manageable increments. And notice, I didn't name a specific time for you to get up. I'm not asking for 4 a.m. The hour doesn't even have to be early. The goal is to give you enough time to move with intention and do things completely. That spirit will carry through the day. Create a time cushion at the beginning of the day, or you'll spend the rest of the day searching for it. I guarantee you will never find that extra time in the middle of the day. Steal it from your morning sleep and give that sleep back to yourself at night. See what changes. Try this. Ease into an earlier wake up. This week, wake up just 15 minutes earlier. You'll probably have to use an alarm, but make it a gentle one. Use low lighting when you first wake up. Put on quiet music. Don't pick up your phone for at least those bonus 15 minutes. Give your brain this time to set a tone for the day ahead. After 1 week of this, roll your wake time back another 15 minutes. Now you have half an hour that is all yours. How will you choose to spend it? You might take a longer shower, sip your tea, go for a walk, meditate, spend a moment cleaning up after yourself before you step out the door. At night, turn off the TV and phone and get in bed whenever you feel the first twinge of fatigue. Found time. Once you've created space in the morning, it is yours alone. Nobody else controls how you use it. Given how much of our time is controlled by our obligations, job, family, etc., this free time is one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves. You might go about your ordinary routine, but feel the space and leisure created by more time. Maybe you have time to make your own coffee instead of grabbing it en route. You can have a conversation over breakfast, read the paper, or use your newfound time to exercise. If you have a meditation, you can start the day with a gratitude visualization practice. Maybe, as health experts are fond of recommending, you'll park further from work to add a bit of a walk to your morning. When you create this space, you'll realize it fills with what you lack most of all, time for yourself. Try this, a new morning routine. Every morning, make some time for the following. Thankfulness. Express gratitude to someone, some place, or something every day. This includes thinking it, writing it, and sharing it. Make time for insight. Gain insight through reading the paper or a book or listening to a podcast. Meditation. Spend 15 minutes alone, breathing, visualizing, or with sound. I'll be sharing more on this later. And exercise. We monks did yoga, but you can do some basic stretches or a workout. Thankfulness, insight, meditation, exercise. T-I-M-E. A new way to put time into your morning. The evening routine. At the ashram, I learned that the morning is defined by the evening. It's natural for us to treat each morning like a new beginning, but the truth is that our days circle on themselves. You don't set your alarm in the morning, you set it the night before. It follows that if you want to wake up in the morning with intention, you need to start that momentum by establishing a healthy, restful evening routine. And so the attention we've given the mornings begins to expand and define the entire day. There is no way you have time to wake up 1 hour earlier, but how often do you switch on the TV, settle on one show or another, and end up watching until past midnight? You watch TV because you're unwinding. You're too tired to do anything else. But earlier sleep time can put you in a better mood. Human growth hormone, HGH, is kind of a big deal. It plays a key role in growth, cell repair, and metabolism, and without it, we might even die sooner. As much as 75% of the HGH in our bodies is released when we sleep, and research shows that our highest bursts of HGH typically come between 10 p.m. and midnight. So if you're awake during those hours, you're cheating yourself of HGH. If you have a job that goes past midnight, or little kids who keep you up, feel free to ignore me. But waking up before the demands of your day begin should not be at the expense of good sleep. If you spend that 10 to midnight getting real rest, it wouldn't be so hard to find those hours in the morning. In the ashram, we spent the evening studying and reading and went to sleep between 8 and 10. We slept in pitch darkness with no devices in the room. We slept in t-shirts and shorts, never in our robes, which carried the energy of the waking day. Morning sets the tone of the day, but a well-planned evening prepares you for the morning. In an interview on CNBC's Make It, Instagram Shark Tank star Kevin O'Leary said that before he goes to sleep, he writes down 3 things he wants to do the next morning before he talks to anyone besides his family. Take his cue, and before you go to sleep, figure out the first things you want to achieve tomorrow. Knowing what you're tackling first will simplify your morning. You won't have to push or force your mind when it's just warming up. And bonus, those tasks won't keep you up at night if you know you're going to handle them. Next, find your version of a monk's robe, a uniform that you'll put on in the morning. I have a bigger selection of clothes now, and to my wife's relief, none of them are orange robes, but I favor similar sets of clothes in different colors. The point is to remove challenges from the morning. Insignificant as they may seem, if you're spending your morning deciding what to eat, what to wear, and what tasks to tackle first, the accumulating choices complicate things unnecessarily. Christopher Sommer, a former U.S. national team gymnastics coach with 40 years' experience, tells his athletes to limit the number of decisions they have to make because each decision is an opportunity to stray from their path. If you spend your morning making trivial decisions, you'll have squandered that energy. Settle into patterns and make decisions the night before, and you'll have a head start on the morning and will be better able to make focused decisions throughout the day. Finally, consider what your last thoughts are before going to sleep. Are they, "This screen is going blurry, I'd better turn off my phone," or "I forgot to wish my mother happy birthday"? Don't program yourself to wake up with bad energy. Every night when I'm falling asleep, I say to myself, "I am relaxed, energized, and focused. I am calm, enthusiastic, and productive." It has a yoga robot vibe when I put it on paper, but it works for me. I am programming my mind to wake up with energy and conviction. The emotion you fall asleep with at night is most likely the emotion you'll wake up with in the morning. A stone on the path. The goal of all this preparation is to bring intentionality to the entire day. The moment you leave your home, there'll be more curveballs, whatever your job may be. You're going to need the energy and focus you cultivated all morning. Monks don't just have morning routines and nighttime routines. We use routines of time and location every moment of the day. Sister Joan Chittister, the Benedictine nun I've already mentioned, says people living in the cities and suburbs, can make choices about the way they live, though most of them don't see that because they are conditioned to be on the go all the time. Imagine for a moment what America would look like. Imagine the degree of serenity we'd have if lay people had something comparable to the daily schedule of cloistered life. It provides scheduled time for prayer, work, and recreation. Routines root us. The 2 hours I spend meditating support the other 22 hours of my day, just as the 22 hours influence my meditation. The relationship between the two is symbiotic. In the ashram, we took the same 30-minute walk on the same path at least once a day. Every day, the monk asked us to keep our eyes open for something different, something we'd never before seen on this walk that we had taken yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Spotting something new every day on our familiar walk was a reminder to keep our focus on that walk, to see the freshness in each routine, to be aware. Seeing something is not the same as noticing it. Researchers at UCLA asked faculty, staff, and students in the Department of Psychology whether they knew the location of the nearest fire extinguisher. Only 24% could remember where the closest one was, even though for 92% of the participants, a fire extinguisher was just a few feet from where they filled out the survey, which was usually their own office or a classroom they frequently visited. One professor didn't realize that there was a fire extinguisher just inches from the office he'd occupied for 25 years. Truly noticing what's around us keeps our brains from shifting to autopilot. At the ashram, we were trained to do this on our daily walk. I have taken this walk for hundreds of days now. It is hot but not unpleasant in my robes. The forest is leafy and cool. The dirt path feels soothing underfoot. Today, a senior monk has asked us to look for a new stone, one that we have never noticed before. I am slightly disappointed. For the past week or so, we've been asked to look for a new flower every day. And yesterday, I lined up an extra one for today. A tiny blue flower cupping a drop of dew that seemed to wink at me as if it were in on my plan. But no, our leader is somehow onto me and has switched things up, and so the hunt is on. Monks understand that routine frees your mind, but the biggest threat to that freedom is monotony. People complain about their poor memories, but I've heard it said that we don't have a retention problem, we have an attention problem. By searching for the new, you're reminding your brain to pay attention and rewiring it to recognize that there's something to learn in everything. Life isn't as certain as we assume. How can I advocate both for establishing routines and seeking out novelty? Aren't these contradictory? But it is precisely doing the familiar that creates room for discovery. The late Kobe Bryant was onto this. The basketball legend had started showing his creative side, developing books and a video series. As Bryant told me on my podcast, On Purpose, having a routine is critical to his work. A lot of the time, creativity comes from structure. When you have those parameters and structure, then within that, you can be creative. If you don't have structure, you're just aimlessly doing stuff. Rules and routines ease our cognitive burden so we have bandwidth for creativity. Structure enhances spontaneity, and discovery reinvigorates the routine. This approach leads to delight in small things. We tend to anticipate the big events of life. Holidays, promotions, birthday parties. We put pressure on these events to live up to our expectations. But if we look for small joys, we don't have to wait for them to come up on the calendar. Instead, they await us every day if we take the time to look for them. And I found it! Here, a curious orangey stone that has seemingly appeared out of nowhere since yesterday. I turn it over in my palm. Finding the stone isn't the end of our discovery process. We observe it deeply, describe the color, the shape, immerse ourselves in it in order to understand and appreciate it. Then we might describe it again to be sure we've experienced it fully. This isn't an exercise. It's real. A deep experience. I smile before returning it to the edge of the path, half hidden, but there for someone else to find. To walk down the same old path and find a new stone is to open your mind. Try this visualization for tomorrow. Just as an inventor has to visualize an idea before building it, we can visualize the life we want, beginning by visualizing how we want our mornings to be. After you do breathwork to calm your mind, I want you to visualize yourself as your best self. Visualize yourself waking up in the morning healthy, well-rested, and energized. Imagine the sunlight coming through the windows. You get up, and as your feet touch the ground, you feel a sense of gratitude for another day. Really feel that gratitude, and then say in your mind, "I am grateful for today. I am excited for today. I am joyful for today." See yourself brushing your teeth, taking your time, being mindful to brush every tooth. Then, as you go into the shower, visualize yourself feeling calm, balance, ease, stillness. When you come out of the shower, because you chose what you were going to wear the night before, it's not a bother to dress. Now see yourself setting your intentions, writing down, "My intention today is to be focused. My intention today is to be disciplined. My intention today is to be of service." Visualize the whole morning again as realistically as you can. You may add some exercise, some meditation. Believe it, feel it. Welcome it into your life, feeling fresh, feeling fueled. Now visualize yourself continuing the day as your best self. See yourself inspiring others, leading others, guiding others, sharing with others, listening to others, learning from others, being open to others, their feedback, and their thoughts. See yourself in this dynamic environment, giving your best and receiving your best. Visualize yourself coming home at the end of the day. You're tired, but you're happy. You want to sit down and rest, but you're grateful for whatever you have. A job, a life, family, friends, a home. You have more than so many people. See yourself in the evening. Instead of being on your phone or watching a show, you come up with new ideas to spend that time meaningfully. When you visualize yourself getting into bed at a good time, see yourself looking up and saying, "I'm grateful for today. I will wake up tomorrow feeling healthy, energized, and rested. Thank you." Then visualize yourself scanning throughout your body and thanking each part of your body for helping you throughout the day. When you're ready, in your own time, at your own pace, slowly and gently, open your eyes. Note, life messes up your plans. Tomorrow is not going to go as you visualize it. Visualization doesn't change your life, but it changes how you see it. You can build your life by returning to the ideal that you imagined. Whenever you feel that your life is out of alignment, you realign it with the visualization. Chew your drinks and drink your food. Monk training wasn't just about spotting the new. It was about doing familiar things with awareness. One afternoon, a senior monk told us, "Today we will have a silent lunch. Remember to chew your drinks and drink your food." "What does that mean?" I asked. "We don't take the time to consume our food properly," the monk said. "When you drink your food, grind the solids into liquid. When you chew your drink, instead of gulping it down, take each sip as if it is a morsel to be savored." If a monk can be mindful of a single sip of water, imagine how this carries through to the rest of daily life. How can you rediscover the everyday? When you exercise, can you see the route that you run or feel the rhythms of the gym differently? Do you see the same woman walking her dog every day? Could you greet her with a nod? When you shop for food, can you take time to choose the perfect apple or the most unusual one? Can you have a personal exchange with the cashier? Try this. Same old, same new. Look for something new in a routine that you already have. What can you spy on your commute that you have never seen before? Try starting a conversation with someone you see regularly but haven't ever engaged. Do this with one new person every day and see how your life changes. In your physical space, how can you look at things freshly? There are articles all around our homes and our workspaces that we have put out because they please us. Photos, knickknacks, art objects. Look at yours closely. Are these a true reflection of what brings you joy? Are there other favorites that deserve a turn in the spotlight and inject some novelty into your familiar surroundings? Add flowers to a vase or rearrange your furniture to find new brightness and purpose in familiar possessions. Simply choosing a new place for incoming mail can change it from clutter to part of an organized life. We can awaken the familiarity of home by changing things up. Have music playing when your partner comes home if that's something you don't usually do, or vice versa. If you usually put on music or a podcast when you get home, try silence instead. Bring a strange piece of fruit home from the store and put it in the middle of the dinner table. Introduce a topic of conversation to your dinner companions or take turns reporting three surprising moments in the day. Switch the light bulb to a softer or clearer light. Flip the mattress. Sleep on the wrong side of the bed. Appreciating the everyday doesn't even have to involve change so much as finding value in everyday activities. In his book, At Home in the World, the monk Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "To my mind, the idea that doing dishes is unpleasant can occur only when you aren't doing them. If I am incapable of washing dishes joyfully, if I want to finish them quickly, so I can go and have dessert or a cup of tea, I will be equally incapable of enjoying my dessert or my tea when I finally have them. Each thought, each action in the sunlight of awareness becomes sacred. In this light, no boundary exists between the sacred and the profane." Try this. Transform the mundane. Even a task as quotidian as doing the dishes can transform if you let it. Allow yourself to be in front of the sink, committed to a single task. Instead of putting on music, focus all your senses on the dishes. Watch their surfaces go from grimy to clean. Smell the dish soap. Feel the steam of the hot water. Observe how satisfying it is to see the sink go from full to empty. There is a Zen koan that says, "Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water." No matter how much we grow, we are never free of daily chores and routines. But to be enlightened is to embrace them. The outside may look the same, but inside you are transformed. Every moment of the day. We've talked about taking an ordinary, familiar moment and finding new ways to appreciate it. To take that presence to another level, we try to string these moments together so that we're not picking and choosing certain walks or dishwashing episodes to make special. We're elevating our awareness of every moment at every moment. We're all familiar with the idea of being in the moment. It's not hard to see that if you're running a race, you won't be able to go back and change how fast you ran at mile 2. Your only opportunity to succeed is in that moment. Whether you are at a work meeting or having dinner with friends, the conversations you have, the words you choose, you won't ever have another opportunity just like that one. In that moment, you can't change the past, and you're deciding the future, so you might as well be where you are. Kalidas, the great Sanskrit writer of the 5th century, wrote, "Yesterday is but a dream. Tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness and every tomorrow a vision of hope." We may all agree that living in the present makes sense, but the truth is that we're only willing to have selective presence. We're willing to be present at certain times, during a favorite show or a yoga class, or even during the mundane task we've chosen to elevate. But we still want to be distracted when we choose to be distracted. We spend time at work dreaming about going on a beach vacation, but then on the beach, long-awaited drink in hand, we're annoyed to find that we can't stop thinking about work. Monks learn that these two scenarios are connected. A desired distraction at work bleeds into unwanted distraction on vacation. Distraction at lunch bleeds into the afternoon. We are training our minds to be when we physically aren't. If you allow yourself to daydream, you will always be distracted. Being present is the only way to live a truly rich and full life. Location has energy. It is easier to see the value of being present throughout an ordinary day, and easier to be truly present if you understand and appreciate the benefits that routine has to offer. Routines aren't just about actions. They're also about the locations in which those actions take place. There's a reason people study better in libraries and work better in offices. New York City imparts its hustle and bustle, while LA makes you feel laid back. Each environment, from the biggest city to the smallest corner of a room, has its own particular energy. Every location gives off a different feeling, and your dharma thrives or falters in specific environments. We're constantly experiencing a range of activities and environments, but we don't pause to contemplate which ones most appeal to us. Do you thrive in busy environments or in solitude? Do you like the safety of cozy nooks or spacious libraries? Do you prefer to be surrounded by stimulating artwork and music, or does uncluttered simplicity help you concentrate? Do you like to bounce ideas off others or to get feedback after completing a job? Do you prefer familiarity or a change of scenery? Having this self-awareness serves your dharma. It means that when you step into a job interview, you have a better sense of how you will perform at this job and whether it's a good match. It means that when you plan a date, you can choose a space where you will be most comfortable. When you imagine different careers within your skill set, you know which ones are best suited to your sensibilities. Try this: environmental awareness. For every environment where you spend time this week, ask yourself the following questions. If possible, ask them right after the experience, then again at the end of the week. What were the key features of the space? Quiet or loud? Big or small? Vibrant or plain? In the center of an active space or removed? Close to other people or isolated? How did I feel in this space? Productive? Relaxed? Distracted? Did the activity I was doing fit well with the place where I was doing it? Was I in the best mindset for what I set out to do? If not, is there another place where I'm more comfortable accomplishing what I planned? The more your personal spaces are devoted to single, clear purposes, the better they will serve you, not just in the fulfillment of your dharma, but in your mood and productivity. Just as the room where we monks slept was designed for nothing but sleep, so every place in the ashram was devoted to a single activity. We didn't read or meditate where we slept. We didn't work in the refectory. In the world outside an ashram, to watch Netflix and or eat in your bedroom is to confuse the energy of that space. If you bring those energies to your bedroom, it becomes harder to sleep there. Even in the tiniest apartment, you can dedicate spaces to different activities. Every home should have a place to eat, a place to sleep, a sacred space that helps you feel calm, and a space that feels comforting when you are angry. Create spaces that bring you the energy that matches your intention. A bedroom should have few distractions, calm colors, soft lighting. Ideally, it should not contain your workspace. Meanwhile, a workspace should be well lit, uncluttered, and functional, with art that inspires you. When you identify where you thrive, focus on expanding those opportunities. If you're drawn to the energy of a nightclub in your leisure time, would you do better in a career that is equally vibrant? If you're a rock musician, but you thrive in quiet, then maybe you should be composing music instead of performing. If you have the perfect job working from home, but you prefer the activity of an office, look to move your work to a cafe or shared workspace. The point is to be aware about where you thrive, where you're at your best, and to figure out how to spend the most time in that place. Of course, we're all obligated to do activities we don't like in environments that aren't ideal, especially work. And we've all experienced the negative energies that these activities generate. With elevated awareness, we understand what has made us impatient, stressed, or drained, and develop guidelines for what living in our dharma, in the right environment with the right energy, would look like. This should be the long-term goal. Sound design your life. Your location and your senses speak to each other. This is most obvious when we think about the sounds that we encounter every day. In monk life, the sounds we hear relate directly to what we are doing. We wake up to birds and winds. We hear chanting as we walk into a meditation. There is no painful noise. But the modern world is getting louder. Planes howl overhead, dogs bark, drills whine. We're subjected to uncontrollable noise all day. We think we're ignoring the honk and clatter of daily life, but all of it adds to our cognitive load. The brain processes sound even when we don't consciously hear it. At home, many of us retreat to silence, so we live in the extremes of silence and noise. Instead of tuning out the noise in your life, sound design it. Start by picking the best alarm tone in the world. Begin the day with a song that makes you happy. On your way to work, listen to a beloved audiobook, a favorite podcast, or your go-to playlist. Choose sounds that make you feel happier and healthier, the better to replicate the highly curated life in an ashram. Time has memory. When we tailor our locations for specific purposes, we're better able to summon the right kind of energy and attention. The same is true for time. Doing something at the same time every day helps us remember to do it, commit to it, and do it with increasing skill and facility. If you're accustomed to going to the gym every morning at the same time, try going in the evening for a change, and you'll see what a challenge it is. When we do something at the same time every day, that time keeps that memory for us. It holds the practice. It saves the space. When you want to incorporate a new habit into your routine, like meditating or reading, don't make it more difficult by trying to do it whenever you have a free moment. Slot it into the same time every day. Even better, link the new practice to something that's already a habit. A friend of mine wanted to incorporate daily yoga into her schedule, so she laid a mat right next to her bed. She literally rolled out of bed and into her yoga practice. Marrying habits is a way of circumventing excuses. Location has energy. Time has memory. If you do something at the same time every day, it becomes easier and natural. If you do something in the same space every day, it becomes easier and natural. Single tasking. Time and location help us maximize the moment, but there is one essential component to being wholly present in that moment: single tasking. Studies have found that only 2% of us can multitask effectively. Most of us are terrible at it, especially when one of those tasks require a lot of focus. When we think we're multitasking, what's usually happening is that we're shifting rapidly among several different things, or serial tasking. This fragmented attention actually erodes our ability to focus, so doing just one thing at a time without distraction becomes harder. Researchers from Stanford University took a group of students and divided them into two groups: those who frequently switch among multiple streams of media, checking email, social media, and headline news, for instance, and those who don't. They put the groups through a series of attention and memory tasks, such as remembering sequences of letters and focusing on certain colored shapes while ignoring others, and the media multitaskers consistently performed poorly. They even did worse on a test of task-switching ability. To make single-tasking easier for myself, I have no tech zones and times. My wife and I don't use tech